A gracious good evening to you all. Welcome to the 1996 James Madison Lecture. As students, we have been challenged to build upon the legacy that are the people that have come before us in our various institutions. Here at Loyola, we are committed to intellectual honesty, committed to our community, and committed to personal integrity. Indeed, as our chairman and moderator has stated, there is more to the law than just earning a living. Please join me in welcoming our Loyola alum, our chairman and moderator for the 1996 James Madison Lecture, Justice Harry T. Lemon at Louisiana Supreme Court.
Thank you very much. It's my first pleasure this evening to introduce the person who will introduce the guest speaker of the evening. Harvey Cook, New Orleans lawyer, unfortunately a Tulane graduate, but has been very, very helpful to Loyola in many, many ways. He's helped us with the Ainsworth Lecture primarily, that I've had some responsibility for, and he has also helped to found the Federalist Society chapter here at Loyola, and indeed is on the board of trustees of the Federalist Society, and I'd like to present to you Mr. Harvey C. Cook.
Thank you, Justice, and distinguished guests and Dean. This evening, I just want to say a few words about the Federalist Society. You have in your brochure the information on who's on the board of directors, the names that you'll recognize, U.S. Senator, the U.S. Congressman who started the Federalist Society only in 1982. All three of the founders worked for your principal speaker tonight, General Meese, in the Justice Department after they graduated from law school, having founded the Federalist Society while in law school. The main reason for the founding of the Federalist Society was to bring back into the mainstream of thinking the original intent argument, for one thing, but to get back into the concept of the Federalist Papers, 78 in particular, and that the law is not a matter of will, but is a matter of following the law and the Constitution in particular. Now, that is will be subject of the debate tonight, so I won't get into that any further. I will tell you this, that the ideas that are in the Federalist Papers, that the ideas that are in the Constitution are what we're here tonight to discuss. We're not here to discuss people who were buried 200 or 300 years ago. When they were buried, their ideas lived on, and that's what we're here to talk about tonight, and that's what the Federalist Society tries to do through having debates around the country where people from any side of any question, libertarians, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats. One of the most popular combinations we have is Judge Bork and Nadine Strassner of the UCLA, of the, excuse me, of the Eugene, Ms. Strassner has debated us on a number of occasions in the CLU, and I'm sorry for the momentary lapse. The it must be a block, but it really isn't. The Ms. Strassner, representing the ACLU, has articulated her positions in a number of our lectures and a number of our debates, and at this point in time represents what we think in terms of the debate that goes on within the Federalist Society, something that makes it worthwhile and validates its purpose. Tonight, we are presenting to you a group of panelists who bring you views which we think you'll find interesting, stimulating, and will bring you into a discourse where you will have to make some decisions as to what you think is the way that the law should be interpreted. And that's what we're trying to do. This started in New Orleans at Tulane 10 years ago and has continued since then when Mr. Meese gave his original intent speech. We have gone from that until this 10 years to the point where we're in full circle and have something to present tonight that we hope you will find useful and stimulating. The Federalist Society is a membership organization. You're welcome to join as students or as lawyers. And as a matter of fact, the membership of lawyers is now up to 4,000 over the last 12 years, and students range anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000. The nature of student is always fluctuates, of course, but we seem to be growing throughout the country. And once again, it's a place where you can bring your ideas and you can debate them in a very good atmosphere. Now, my next job tonight is to introduce to you the person who will really introduce Mr. Meese. And it has been my pleasure and over the last year to get to know Vern Spears. Vern started out at Loyola. He's now at Tulane and was president of the Federalist Society here and is now in charge of all of the Federalist Society student groups in Louisiana and is coordinating their efforts. And tonight we have a representation of at least three of the four law schools. I haven't confirmed that exactly who's here, but we've invited the deans of all four law schools and we've invited the students of all the law schools to be here. And we know we have a very good representation and a cross-section from throughout the state and its law schools. And we're proud of that. The crowd you see tonight, we fully understand, is because of Mr. Meese and the speech that he's going to deliver. I think you will find stimulating. Mr. Spears will introduce him. Mr. Spears graduated from the Citadel and was an outstanding student there and is from California. And his father worked at one point as a assistant attorney general for Mr. Meese at the Justice Department in the 80s. So with no further ado, and thanking you for your attention, and thank you for being here, and we welcome you into the ranks of the Federalist Society if you haven't already joined, Mr. Vern Spears.
I promise to be very, very brief. Thank you, Mr. Cook. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests and panelists, fellow Federalists and law students to the 1996 James Madison Lecture. Tonight, the Federalist Society is deeply honored to present to you one of the most influential legal scholars and important constitutional commentators of our day. Currently, he holds the Ronald Reagan Chair in Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He is also a distinguished visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. In 1992, he authored With Reagan, The Inside Story. And the inside story begins in the 1960s in Alameda County, California, where he served as deputy district attorney. Then, starting in 1967, he became Governor Reagan's legal affairs secretary, executive assistant, and chief of staff. From 1981 to 1985, he held the position of counselor to the president. And then he served as both a member of the president's cabinet and as a member of the National Security Council. From 1985 to 1988, he served as Attorney General of the United States. I personally have had the distinct privilege of benefiting from his friendship, advice, and counsel on many occasions. His candor, intellectual honesty, personal integrity, and concern for young people is a model for academics, jurists, and national political leaders alike. Thus, I could not be more honored to introduce to you a friend and the 75th Attorney General of the United States, the Honorable Edwin Meese III.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Vern, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real privilege for me to be here tonight. I want to thank all of you for being here. I would mention each of the people who has preceded me and acknowledge them, but that would take longer than my talk, and so, but I do appreciate all of them and their good words, and I'm particularly honored to be invited to give the 1996 James Madison lecture here, because, of course, James Madison is a very important figure to the Federalist Society, as you see from the banner, you see from our neckties, and I hope that only that I can do him justice in the course of my remarks this evening. But it's awfully good of Justice Lemon to serve as our chairman this evening and to bring the majesty of the Supreme Court of Louisiana to this occasion. I'm also very pleased to have the chance to be here at Loyola University Law School. I was tremendously impressed as the dean was talking a little bit about legal education here. My background, and that's why I kind of enjoy this setting, it reminds me of my days when I was a law professor at the University of San Diego, a somewhat sister institution, as it were. The ideas that he's bringing to this law school, and particularly the close relationship between the academy, the legal education programs here, and the practicing bar, I think is a tremendous step forward, and one of the things that is vitally necessary in all of our law schools, really, in order to do a better job both of producing the kinds of lawyers that can handle the challenges that are ahead in the law, and also at the same time, as he pointed out, make law school interesting, and by bringing the profession into the law schools. And I certainly commend you, Dean, and Loyola Law School for that. I want to thank both Vernon Spears and Harvey Cook for all the work that went into it and the other people who have worked with them. As I mentioned earlier when we were talking on the way down here, I received on virtually a weekly, if not a semi-weekly basis, communications from Vern and the committee as to the plans going back to several months ago. And the planning and arrangements for this event are second only to the D-Day invasion in 1944, I can assure you, in terms of the good work that's been done. Well, as Harvey Cook mentioned, the discussions about the Constitution today are not simply historical lessons about people who have been dead two centuries or more. But indeed, with the decisions of the Supreme Court, with some of the very interesting things that are happening, with some of the things that are happening in the Congress of the United States now, the Constitution is, again, a live issue. As a matter of fact, we find, it was mentioned that one of the Federalist activities is Bob Bork debating Nadine Strozin, who comes from New York Law School, by the way. In terms of their contrasting views of the Constitution. And I think Bob Bork has done a tremendous job also around the country, along with the Federalist Society, to raise constitutional issues and put them in a way in which the public can understand that this is something that's important to me. And certainly in the legal profession, he has raised that issue a great deal. As a matter of fact, some of you are probably familiar with the fact with his recent book, which has just come out over the last couple of weeks, called Slouching Towards Gomorrah, which may give you a hint as to how he views the state of the world today. But one of the interesting things he raises is the condition of the Constitution and the Supreme Court today in interpreting the Constitution. As was reported in a recent article on this, it says, Judge Bork thinks the court is basically an instrument of the intellectual class. The law schools, the academy, the foundations, the media, the arts community, and activists on the left. Generally, he feels that the court can be relied on to enact the agenda of its class, finding whatever principles it wishes to in the Constitution, imposing its own cultural and political values on large and unwilling majorities. What matters, Judge Bork writes, is that the result be consonant with the modern liberal mood. Well, this is an important statement about the court, but it does go to kind of the heart of what we're talking about tonight, and that is the whole idea of original intent, or more particularly, how do we interpret the Constitution, what is the function of judges, and what is the relationship between the democratic aspects of government, that is, the expression of the will of the people through their elected representatives, on the one hand, and the role of the court in construing and applying the Constitution, on the other. One of the other professors who's done a great deal of writing about this is Marianne Glendon, who's a professor at the Harvard Law School. And she recently seconded, if you will, in her book, the comments of Judge Bork, in which she referred to the intellectual elite as, quote, the semi-skilled knowledge class. And she says, it's common attitude that the educated are better equipped to govern the masses finds its institutional expression in a disdain for ordinary politics and the legislative process, and a preference for extending the authority of the courts, the branch of government to which they have the easiest access. And so that's kind of at the heart of our discussion tonight. Obviously, our Constitution, which is the basis for our governmental and our legal system, is the longest enduring and the most often imitated governmental charter in the world. It was described by one admirer from a foreign country as, quote, the most wonderful work ever struck off at a given time by the brain and purpose of man, unquote. But one of the things that that wonderful document did, and again in the hyperbole of that statement, was to create something that was totally new in the world in 1787, and that was an independent judiciary. A judiciary that was not under the control of the legislative body or the parliament as it would have been in a European country or Britain. It was not under the control of the executive branch or under the king or the monarch, but it was truly independent. And of course, they did the two things in the Constitution to make it independent. They said, first of all, that the justices of the Supreme Court, and then by inference, the other courts to be created later by Congress under Article 3, would in fact have life tenure, that they could not be removed except for good cause, which would be a violation of what the Constitution calls good behavior. And secondly, that their compensation could not be decreased while they were in office. And these weren't just administrative provisions of the Constitution. They were vital precepts that ensured the independence of the judiciary. The founders had a great deal of confidence in the role of the court as a means of limiting the power of the other two branches. And interestingly enough, as those of you who have read the Federalist Papers will remember, the court was described, and the judiciary was described, as the weakest of the three branches. Because, as the papers read, the Congress had the power of the purse, the executive had the power of the sword, and the court had neither sword nor purse, but only judgment. Well, today our question, I guess, is, were the founders wrong in trusting an independent judiciary? Certainly, I think no one today would contend that the judiciary is the weakest branch of government. But the question is, was this arrangement to have a judicial branch independent and capable of limiting governmental power and interpreting the Constitution and the laws of the country, was that a good move in terms of providing for what is ultimately the purpose of the Constitution, and that is maintaining and protecting the liberty of the people? Well, the answer really is in how judges use their power and whether or not they do in fact carry out the function for which the judiciary was intended, the interpretation and the application of law, and whether they pursue policies of constitutional fidelity, and that is an understanding of and a following of the limited role of the judiciary. And I'd like to talk about this in terms of several ideas. First of all, what is the faithful interpretation of the Constitution and of law? What is this role of the judiciary? Secondly, how is it accomplished, and can you accomplish it, really? Thirdly, why is it essential? And fourth, what happens when concepts like original intent are not followed? Let's talk about, first of all, about this whole idea of faithful interpretation of the Constitution. And what is this matter of original intent? Well, to start with, it is not trying to look into the minds of James Madison or any of the others who were involved in the Constitution, or to take an Ouija board and say, and turn off the lights and say, what did they really mean? What was in their deeper, most innermost consciences? But rather, it really is the adherence to the language of the Constitution or a statute, whatever is being construed, and giving the words the meaning that was intended by those who are parties to the document. In the one case, the people, through their representatives ratifying the Constitution, and in the other, the elected bodies of the people, the legislative bodies, the Congress, or the state legislatures, or their elected representatives in terms of the executive branch, who are carrying out the will of the people at any particular time. How is this accomplished, then? How do you do this? Well, I think it's important to recognize the defense, the classic defense of the judiciary, as Alexander Hamilton stated, And he said an independent judiciary under the Constitution would prove to be what he called the citadel of public justice and the public security. And he said that courts were peculiarly essential in a limited constitution. Now, by limited constitution, he didn't mean that the Constitution was limited. He meant the Constitution was a limit on the power of government. Without the courts, he said, there would be no security against the encroachments and oppressions of the representative body, and no protection against unjust and partial laws. Well, Hamilton knew, like his colleague James Madison, that all political power is of an encroaching nature. And the whole idea of the Constitution was to divide that power, and if you will, to set up separate and competing agencies or branches within the federal government, so as they said, ambition would check ambition. The purpose of the Constitution was the creation of a limited as well as energetic government. In a sense, a contradiction in terms. But that was the dynamic tension, if you will, that the founders developed within the Constitution and the way in which they set up the structure of our government. As Madison put it, the whole idea behind the Constitution was to enable the government to control the governed, but also obliged to control itself. De Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, in the early portions of the 19th century, as he came from France to observe democracy in America, was often coming from a foreign country, was often a very astute observer of what went on there. And one of the things he said about this independent judiciary and having a judicial branch, empowered as it was that it had a moral force with the great object of justice, he said, was to substitute the idea of right for that of violence. And he went on to say that in essence, by having a court determine what was morally right and what was correct, that this made much less necessary the government to use the power of the sword or to use the physical force that it had at its command. And that rather that through a system of laws and through a system of judicial decision, we had created a moral force that often made the use of physical force unnecessary, but where physical force was necessary by the government, it had a legitimacy that it wouldn't have had but for the sanction, but for the authority that went from the moral force in the court. So the important thing is that the court exercise in its interpretation of the law, in its application of the Constitution, the proper rendition of that moral force. And when you really get right down to it, interpreting the Constitution or a statute is very much like interpreting any other legal document. The idea is that a jurisprudence of original intent, if you will, reflects a deep-rooted commitment to the idea of democracy. And that is the Constitution, an understanding that the Constitution represents the consent of the governed to the structures and the power of the government. The Constitution is the fundamental will of the people, and that's why it's the fundamental law. And to allow the courts to govern simply by what it views at a particular point in time as fair and accurate or fair and decent is a scheme of government that is no longer in recognition of the popular will, because the idea of democracy has suffered inasmuch as the ideas of the judges as to what might be popular or what might be fair or what might be decent, their subjective views, if you will, really should have no application to the Constitution. But rather, the Constitution should be interpreted in terms of its language. And if its language is in a particular case, hard to understand or hard to apply, then an understanding of what was the meaning of at the time that the Constitution was ratified, was drafted, or its amendments were drafted and ratified. Justice Story, who was sometimes called the lawyer's everyman because he was a lawyer, he was a justice, he was a teacher of the law, had a theory of judging that I think is worthwhile in terms of how you properly interpret the Constitution. He said, in construing the Constitution of the United States, we are in the first instance to consider what are its nature and objects, its scope and design, as apparent from the structure of the instrument, viewed as a whole, and also viewed in its component parts. Where its words are plain, clear, and determinate, they require no interpretation. Just follow the language. Or as we used to say, if all else fails, read and follow the law. Where the word admits of two senses, each of which is conformable to general usage, that sense is to be adopted, which, without departing from the liberal import of the words, best harmonizes with the nature and objects, the scope and design of the instrument. Like the interpretation of any legal document, whether it be a contract or a will or the bylaws of a corporation or whatever else it might be, in terms of the role of judges, it is to use the same rules of construction and the same limitations to try to determine and express the will of the parties, the intent of the parties, that is the basis for carrying out properly a jurisprudence of original intention. It would take seriously the admonition of Justice Story's friend and the well-known and well-thought-of early Justice of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice John Marshall, when he said that judges should be cautioned never to forget it is a constitution they are expounding. It is not merely a springboard for their own ideas or a document in which they are at will able to substitute their own views for that of what the Constitution actually says. The big difference, of course, between an ordinary legal document and the Constitution and our federal statutes is that the stakes are bigger as far as the public is concerned, because literally democracy, representative government, if you will, hangs in the balance. Well, why is it essential? I might say, by the way, that the contrary side of interpreting the Constitution with fidelity to its language and interpreting rather than making law is expressed, the opposite of that, of course, is what has been done too many times by the court. In some of the more famous cases like Griswold against Connecticut and some of the others that I'll mention in a few minutes, in which, as Hugo Black, Justice Black dissenting, said, one of the most effective ways of diluting or expanding a constitutionally guaranteed right is to substitute for the crucial word or words of a constitutional guarantee another word or words more or less flexible and more or less restrictive in meaning. And he said when that happens, then in effect, by going away from the words of the Constitution itself and substituting more malleable terms, that enables the judge who would like to make law, who would like to legislate instead of interpret, that gives him then an ability to make the words say what he wants them to make rather to mean rather than what they actually mean in the original form in the Constitution. And he went on to say, I do not believe that we are granted power by any constitutional provision to measure constitutionality by our belief, for example, that legislation is arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable, or accomplishes no justifiable purpose. Such an appraisal of the wisdom of legislation is an attribute of the power to make laws, not of the power to interpret them. And he went on to say how when even though a judge may think that a particular law is rather silly, is rather unreasonable, is rather arbitrary, or is not a good idea, that is not the criteria by which a judge should interpret a law and certainly the Constitution, but rather it was and apply the Constitution to a law, but rather it should be a question of, is a law passed by the legislature something that is absolutely contrary to a specific provision of the Constitution? And then and only then, using a very limited approach in terms of the actual meaning of the Constitution, should an act of either the United States Congress or an act of the states then be declared to be unconstitutional. Well, this is essential basically to preserve democracy, where judges usurp the legislative power, judicial action then becomes just another step in the legislative process. Whereas normally, if you follow the Constitution, the power of the legislature and a law once passed by it and properly signed into law by the president or the executive of a state should be the last word, barring a clear-cut violation of the Constitution. We have a situation that's occurring now in the United States. And it's interesting to note how the constitutional process of legislation has been, in a sense, perverted by what is happening here. Just a few weeks ago, Congress passed the Welfare Reform Law. I doubt if there is any statute that has been more meticulously argued, discussed, gone back and forth over. In fact, in this case, there were two prior versions of the law, each of which were vetoed by the president. So the Congress of the United States has had ample opportunity to look at and investigate and hear arguments and concerns about that law. But what has happened within days, literally, of the president signing? According to one of the Washington newspapers, it said, advocacy groups across the country are poised to go to court as early as next week to challenge the legal underpinnings of the historic new welfare law that begins to take full effect Tuesday. In effect, after years of wrangling on Capitol Hill, it is clear from conversations with dozens of attorneys that the battle over welfare reform is moving from Congress into the courts. Well, it's easy to see then that at least these attorneys view the courts not as mere arbiters of the Constitution or interpreters of the law, but see them as the next step in the legislative process itself. This is why it is important that judges exercise due restraint and not undue liberalism in a judicial sense in terms of interpreting statutes and applying the Constitution. Because it is the only way in which we can preserve the democracy that involves the will of the people expressed through its elective representatives. It's also important, too, that the court do this in order that it not be properly accused of oppression or of tyrannical activity. As a matter of fact, to avoiding tyranny, and indeed in the framers of the Constitution, one of the things that was stated was that when the court usurps the legislative function and when the court combines the legislative, executive, and functions along with its judicial function, that this is the very definition of tyranny. And so it's important that the court, in order to preserve its own limited role under the Constitution, avoid going beyond its role in the interpretation of the laws. James Madison wrote, as I mentioned, that this would be the very definition of tyranny. Thomas Jefferson went even further. Thomas Jefferson, as you know, was not present at the time that the Constitution was drafted. And afterwards, he said that allowing only the unelected judiciary to interpret the Constitution would result in judicial supremacy. And he said, it is a very dangerous doctrine to consider the judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions. It is one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy. Instead, he believed that the Constitution intended concurrent review and interpretation by each branch of government. It was interesting then that only about 15 presidents later or so, Abraham Lincoln, in his first inaugural speech, this wasn't into his term in office, but in his first inaugural, already talked about his concerns about the court. And he said, the candid citizen must confess that if the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by decisions of the Supreme Court, the people will cease to be their own rulers, having to that extent practically resigned their government into the hands of that eminent tribunal. Meaning the court. So this is one of the things, one of the reasons why it is essential that the court understand its limited role and hew to what the Constitution actually says and does in fact act as an interpreter and not substitute its judgment. President Reagan was very much concerned about this, and he was particularly concerned about the fact that each time a federal court strikes down a law or strikes down the practice of the political branches through an activist ruling, that self-government, that is, government by the people, suffers. And he said at the time of the swearing-in ceremony for William Rehnquist as Chief Justice and Nino Scalia as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, he kind of encapsulated his views in these words. He said, the Founding Fathers were clear on this issue. For them, the question involved in judicial restraint was not, as it is not, will we have liberal courts or conservative courts? They knew that the courts, like the Constitution itself, must not be liberal or conservative. The question was and is, will we have government by the people? Well, the results of what has happened when courts do stray from the original intent of the Constitution and make up, in effect, their own constitution can be seen in a number of cases. Time doesn't permit tonight in my remarks, but perhaps we'll get into some of these in the panel discussion later. But where you have the court in cases such as Reynolds against Sims, where they held that the states could no longer have a parallel structure of their legislative branch, parallel to what the United States has, with one branch representing geographical jurisdictions and the other branch apportioned on population. In Reynolds against Sims, the so-called one-man, one-vote decision, they held that the states could not do that and had to apportion both of their houses on the basis of population. Well, I would suggest that if that view of the Constitution, or even the possibility of that view, had even been hinted at in the Constitutional Convention of 1787, that today we would still be operating under the Articles of Confederation or some other similar arrangement, because such an abhorrent idea would have literally caused the original founders to discard any attempt to impose a constitution on the people of the United States. There are other cases in which I mentioned one a minute ago, the Griswold against Connecticut case, where in a flight of fancy, the court determined for itself a new constitutional right never found in any of the language or any of the reasonable interpretations of the Constitution. We had then, as a follow-up to that, a case, Roe against Wade, which illustrates, I think, what happens when the court legislates instead of interprets. Now, however you may feel about the subject of abortion, that's not the issue. The question is whether there was actually a right in the Constitution. And I think at the time, most legal scholars at the time of Roe against Wade, back in the early 1970s, there was general agreement among legal scholars that there was no such right and that this was, in fact, invented by the courts. But I'm not here to argue that as much as I am to show what happens when the courts do substitute their own judgment for what is actually in the Constitution, or what they feel, substitute their own judgment as to what they feel the customs and mores of society ought to be. And that is, since that time, the court has had to stay in the legislative field. Because once having legislated, and the court is not really capable of legislating because they are confined, at least in essence, to the facts of a particular case and a rather limited view of what in this case was a rather large public policy issue. But nevertheless, having ruled, then at each session of the court after that, or almost every session, they have had new versions and new aspects of that issue come up, which has required them to legislate again and again and again and take them totally out of what should be a judicial function and has caused them to be continuing, in essence, to write legislative solutions because of their legislating in the first place. But the other thing is that it has taken a major moral issue on which the public is relatively evenly divided, depending on the way in which the issue is phrased, more on one side perhaps than on the other, but overall, on which there is a great division in our country, and it has taken that moral and policy issue out of the realm of the public policy debate, where traditionally through literally dozens of years in our country it was handled by the people through their legislative representatives, and has removed that issue from the ability of the people's representatives to determine what is the proper policy for our country. And as a result, it has engendered the kind of emotional flashpoints, if you will, that has characterized the implementations of their decision around the country. More recently, in the case of Romer against Evans, the striking down of the Colorado amendment, which was passed by 54% of the people, in which the amendment said that in Colorado, special rights or special protections, special privileges should not be afforded to homosexuals, that in that particular case, the Supreme Court again substituted its judgment for that of the people of Colorado as to what was a valid governmental purpose. The people of Colorado had spoken, and in their minds at least, this served a valid governmental purpose. The Supreme Court, however, decided by a very close vote to exercise its judgment, which conflicted with the people of Colorado. These are the consequences, really, of what happens when the original meaning of the Constitution, the original intent, and the limited role of the judiciary is not followed. In effect, it enables the federal government to increase its power at the expense of the states. It enables the court to increase its power at the expense of the other branches of government, the popularly elected branches, and at the expense of the states. And it creates a situation in which the people themselves are not able to be a part of the solution. And as we've seen in the, certainly in the Roe against Wade case, and I suspect we will continue to see it in the case stated in Romer against Evans, the mere fact that the court has spoken does not solve the problem. The problem will go on in our society. The court has only limited the ability of the people to be a participant in the ongoing efforts to solve the problem. Well, this is the reason why the role of the court and its restraint in exercising its vast powers is very important. Many times it has to be admitted that the legislative branch contributes to this excessive use of judicial power. And one of the things that has now come about, as the court has been on occasion willing to go beyond its judicial function and engage in the legislative function, is that too often a Congress, on difficult and thorny political issues, is willing to legislate so broadly that the meaning of the statute is not clear, and in some cases even audibly state at the time, well, we'll let the courts tell us what it is that we have enacted. Certainly this is as much a violation of the Constitution and its concept of the three different branches of government, and in a situation in which Congress has contributed to this usurpation of authority by the court. The role of the judge, of course, is to be able to articulate a result that is compelled by the Constitution or compelled by the fair meaning of the statute, the original intent of either, as it were, even though he or she disagrees with the result. There are two examples, I think, that are particularly indicative of this. One is in the case of Griswold against Connecticut, which had to do with contraceptive advice being given against the laws of the state of Connecticut. And one of the dissenting judges, when that law was overturned by a majority of the Supreme Court, one of the dissenting justices, Potter Stewart, said this. He said, "I think that this law, passed in 1879, is an uncommonly silly law. But," he said, "we are not asked in this case to say whether we think this law is unwise or even asinine. We are asked to hold that it violates the United States Constitution, or as an expression of political views. Did not like the result, but they felt compelled by the Constitution and the precedents to do that, even though they disagreed with the ultimate act." And that really is the essence, I think, of a judge's limiting his or her acts to what the Constitution requires, where after a clear reading of the Constitution, a clear reading of the precedents, as it was in this case, they and the application of the Constitution to a particular statute, they appreciate the fact that they are compelled, against their own inclinations, to hold that the Constitution prevails. So it seems to me that that is the kind of judicial restraint and limitation on judicial power that is absolutely critical to preserve the constitutionally faithful role of the judiciary. Well, this discussion of constitutional interpretation, of judicial activism, the whole matter of judicial restraint, these are not abstract concepts. These are not things to be relegated to the pages of history books or law review articles or even limited to constitutional law classes. I think that these topics go to the essence of democratic government. They determine the validity of that government, and they vitally affect the public policies at every level of our governmental structure. What could be more a factor in the lives of our citizens today than the aftermath, if you will, of Roe against Wade in the abortion issue and some of the other things that have occurred in similar cases? The Constitution must be restored to its position of supremacy over constitutional law. Judges must understand the limitations of their authority. Public officials in all branches of the government must understand their role and responsibility in interpreting the Constitution. And if Congress, for example, was doing its job of interpreting the Constitution, there would be far fewer laws that would have to be overturned by the Supreme Court, because they have an equal attention, an equal responsibility for attention to constitutional provisions before they enact the statutes. And the members of the public must understand that this debate over the Constitution directly affects them in their lives, and more particularly affects them in their liberty. How we as a nation answer the questions that are raised in our discussion in these remarks now and in our panel tonight will determine the future of constitutional government. It will determine our ability to preserve into the next century our democratic republic, and ultimately it will have a major impact on the liberty and freedom of all of our people. Thank you.
At this point, I'm going to call upon the panelists to take the seat up on the panel here, and first I'd like to call General Meese, who will be in the center. And congratulations on an excellent lecture, which we all enjoy and benefited from. I'll give a brief introduction of each of the panelists as you come up. First, I'd like to call on Martin L.C. Feldman, Honorable Judge of the Eastern District of Louisiana. Marty was appointed to the court in 1983 by President Reagan. He's a graduate of Tulane University School of Law, was a partner in the Bronfen Heller firm here in New Orleans, and was a law clerk for John Minor Wisdom on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. He was recently elected the chairman of the National Conference of Federal Trial Judges in the American Bar Association. Next, Honorable Edith Brown Clement of the Eastern District of Louisiana. Joy Clement was appointed by President Bush in 1991. She was a graduate also of Tulane University, a member of Jones Walker Law Firm, and was a clerk to Judge Herbert Christianberry on the Eastern District, and is a member of the Federalist Society, and is also a member of the Dean's Council of Tulane University. Honorable Eldon E. Fallon of the Eastern District of Louisiana was appointed in 1995 by President Clinton. Eldon is a graduate of Tulane University with an LLM from Yale Law School. Eldon was a partner in the firm of Gainsburg, Benjamin Fallon, and David, and was a past president of the Louisiana State Bar Association and also a past president of Louisiana Bar Foundation. Dean John McDesey, Dean and Professor of Law at Loyola University, whom we've met earlier. John has a BA from Harvard College, JD from the University of Pennsylvania, and an SJD from Harvard Law School. He was a professor of law and associate dean at Cleveland Marshall College of Law, and a dean and professor of law at University of Tulsa Law School just before coming to Loyola. We've had tremendous amount of people who have been impressed by John and with the contributions that you're making to Loyola. And we wish you well here. We appreciate your being on the panel. And the final panelist, my old friend, Professor Paul Richard Beyer of the LSU Law Center. Paul is a George M. Armstrong Professor of Law at the LSU Law Center. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School. He was a clerk on the Michigan Court of Appeals. He was a judicial fellow on the United States Supreme Court, and was a scholar in residence of the Louisiana Bar Association, just to mention a few of his accomplishments, and now is the chairperson of the Bill of Rights section of the State Bar Association. To start off the panel, I'd like to call upon the panelists for commentary on the remarks by General Meese or for perhaps any questions that you might have. Paul?
Well, I'm certainly. First, I
always call on a law professor first. They're never without words or questions.
First, I noticed that when the dean was speaking, he limited himself to 3.5 minutes, and when he finished, he hadn't used a second. So if I may open this colloquy with, let's say, no more than, well, maybe 5 minutes. General, Mr. Justice Holmes once said that if you want to slay a dragon, it's very advisable to get the dragon out of the cave and look him over, size him up. Well, I sat right there, 3 feet from you, as you held forth, and just a perfectly delightful dragon. That's my first comment. I'm glad you're here in this hall. Now, I have sat in the audience, and in this beautiful auditorium, I have heard Mr. Justice Powell. I have heard a close friend, Chief Justice Burger, deliver lectures. And now I find myself in eminent company. I got ready. I must say that I listened to everything you said very carefully. I made 6 pages of notes. And, General, my first comment after the welcome is I disagree with about 90% of what you had to say. Now, what is the basis of the disagreement? I'll go to fundamentals first. I think the idea of originalism is faithless to the framers' originalism. And I pitch that specifically on a comment that you made. You quote, as we all do, John Marshall, and we must never forget it is a constitution we are interpreting. But out of that line, you want a cabin and confine judges, and I think your historical recital can be proven to be wrong. I say that because if you look at the origins of the line, we must never forget it is a constitution we're interpreting. John Marshall knew that words do not have one meaning. And if you look at the generalities, I must say, then I am not a Meesean. And I must also mention that when you mentioned Hugo Black and the dissent in Griswold, that was very dear to me. I'm the editor of Hugo Black's memoirs. But I'm still convinced that Justice Hugo Black and Mr. Justice Stewart in Griswold were wrong. And the consequence of Griswold is not this horrible that you would posit. That is the consequence of continuing legislation. The consequence is we have a wholesome, solid measure of liberty in this country that we owe to the court and to those who do not abide original intent. Justice Blackmun once said in my hearing that we cannot live with original intent. And I believe those judges who've been tested over time would accept that. That's my main objection. I don't think that original intent is faithful to the framers' vision, particularly those who drafted the generalities that we find in the Bill of Rights. Those generalities are not self-defining. You need an institution of government, and that's what Madison and Hamilton knew when they said, as you pointed out, what they said about the important, precious role of courts to protect us against democracies that run amok. And the framers knew that they're capable of doing it, and they have done it over time. And what I say is, thank God we have a Supreme Court of the United States. We do not have elitist judges, not all of them. Not all of them. And the elitist judges that we do have, say I, and I admire them, I respect them, I like a good debate. But certainly Justice Powell and Justice Harry Blackmun, Tom Clark, who gave us rightly, I say, the exclusionary rule, because that's a part of the Fourth Amendment. It's a part of the idea that if we have a right, certainly John Marshall said in Marbury against Madison, that the very essence of the right is a remedy. Well, that's what MAP's all about. I took great offense when I read that General Meese, who now sits with me on the panel, thought Miranda infamous. And since you're in Louisiana, may I say that that Chief Justice Edward Douglas White, 100 years ago, in a case called Bram against the United States that is completely forgotten by all scholars, but in Bram, White said, this is 1897, he said that, well, you trace the Fourth and Fifth Amendment certainly to English liberty, but he thought in a particular case that it would be advisable, given the rights that were at stake, for the police to advise the accused held incommunicado and naked in that case in the room that he had a right to remain silent. What's so infamous about that when you can trace it to our son, Edward Douglas White? I certainly agree with you when you said that Texas against Johnson and United States v. Eichmann was a case in which the court felt constrained to render the judgment of unconstitutionality. May I remind the audience that Mr. Justice Rehnquist thought, based on originalism and what freedom of speech was, that burning the flag was an inarticulable grunt, and that the framers most assuredly would have affirmed the Flag Protection Act of 1989. That came from Kennedy and William Brennan. And I think, I'll finish with this as a preliminary. I think that Justice Kennedy was right when he sat before the senators, summing up his faith to decide whether democracy would put him on the court, the same Senate Judiciary Committee that rejected Robert Bork. Justice Kennedy said, we of the 20th century are in a better position to interpret our Constitution than was John Marshall. And I think that Justice Kennedy, who gave us not only the flag burning case, but he gave us Romer v. Evans just a few months ago, quite striking, quite dramatic. But he's defining equality. And I agree with Justice Kennedy.
General Mace, would you, Eldon? Judge Fallon?
Well, I guess we're going down this way. I don't feel as strongly as Paul does about most things in life. He and I have known each other many years, and I have participated with him on a number of panels, and I can say that to some extent with some certainty. But one thing that I think we ought to focus on is that oftentimes in these days we think in terms of a liberal or conservative. This is not a liberal or conservative issue that we're dealing with here today, and I think it's important for us to recognize that. Justice said the following in dealing with the question of whether or not proof of criminal charge beyond a reasonable doubt is constitutionally required. This justice says, the court has never clearly held, however, that proof beyond a reasonable doubt is either expressly or impliedly commanded by the provision of the Constitution. Nowhere in that document is there any statement to that effect. Says the justice, I believe the court has no power to add to or subtract from the procedures set forth by the founders, and so forth. And he says, as I have said time and time again, I prefer to put my faith in the words of the written Constitution itself rather than to rely on the shifting day-to-day standards of fairness of individual justice. Who was it? Justice Hugo Black, in the famous dissent in In re Winship, a 1970 case. So, and we know that Justice Douglas felt very strongly about no law should silence speech. The problem, though, that I think you have to come to grips with is that there are several provisions in the Constitution that just stand out as follow as written. Article 2, person to be president to be eligible shall not, no one who is eligible who has not attained the age of 35. Clearly, and you stop right there. 35 or over, that's where you have to be. But even that article doesn't solve it for us. No person except a natural-born citizen Well, does that exclude Caesarian-born people?
So
it doesn't, and so you then say, well, you have to go further. You have to go further. And so the question then is, well, what did they mean when they wrote it? So you do have in this document some articles, some provisions which speak for themselves. You have others that need interpretation. And then you have come into articles like the Paul says with the amendments. No law, Justice Douglas's famous underlying no, abridging freedom of speech. Well, it doesn't say anything about the written. It only says speech. But we know in that time that written was communication and speech was probably meant for communication. But it still says no law. But we know from the great Holmes that you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. We see the cases in which it's posited, well, should someone stand in front of a poorly guarded jail and speak racism when the only incarcerated person is a black inside of the jail? Obviously not, but how do we deal with it? Well, some judges have said, well, speech, is this pure speech, or is it under the fingernails a bit of action, and therefore it is not speech anymore, and therefore not protected by the First Amendment? Is it stretching it? Why isn't it speech, purely speech? So I think it's a taffy pull and a difficult one. I think it's essential that we continue to debate this and focus on it. I don't think it's appropriate for us to simply look upon the Constitution as pitches in which judges decide the contents, fill it up, and then empty it and put in all new material. But at the same time, I don't think we are necessarily have to be rigid in our interpretation. But what do we do then? Do we say, well, we should bring up to speed the procedural aspects, make them more modern? They're vehicles into which ideas are driven hither and yon, and they need to be brought up to speed. So it may be okay to fiddle a bit or interpret a bit or modify a bit or pull a bit in order to make the model more modern, in order to get the idea closer to the people. But the substance, the ideas, the norms, the beliefs, the passengers inside of these vehicles, the substantive provisions of the Constitution, if we want to change those, maybe we ought to look to the people to make those decisions and not to individuals who are appointed a lion.
Thank you, Judge Feldman.
Judge Feldman? Feldman, I'm sorry.
Well, first, I think that it's important to recognize at the outset that Professor Byers and General Meese have defined the parameters of the subject matter and done so, I think, with very eloquently. But in saying that, I think that it's important not to lose sight of what it is we're really talking about. I thought it was interesting that Professor Byers, a respecter of James Madison, didn't mention the Madisonian dilemma, and that is majority power and minority freedom, and the need to balance the two in our structure of government, the constant need to do so. And so what we're talking about, I think, is the methodology by which the Constitution is given content. And I slightly disagree with my colleague, Judge Fallon. I think it does implicate some things we call liberal and some things we call conservative. And I think it's a mistake to do that, because the minute you do that, you fall into the very nicely feeling trap intellectually that Professor Byers has fallen into, and that is, I feel good about the good things the court does, or I feel bad about the bad things the court does. And that's where I think liberals and conservatives have lost the ability to communicate with one another. And so I think if you forget about how good you feel about Griswold or how bad you feel about Roe or whatever, I think the important thing to keep in focus when you think in terms of a federal judiciary whose responsibility it is to give content to the Constitution above all other statutes, that we're talking about structure. And there are three, and methodology, and there are three doctrines, if you will, or methods that are implicated in this dialogue. General Meese defines constitutional principles through the idea of original intent, and he's eloquently defined that for you. There are other mutations. One is the most extreme, my friend Justice Scalia's, who is a textualist and who finds the text of even the Constitution to be easy to understand and easy to read. Just one sentence. Recently, he wrote in a dissent in the Umber case. What secret knowledge, one must wonder, is breathed into lawyers when they become justices of this court? Very Scalian. That enable them to discern that a practice which the text of the Constitution does not clearly proscribe, and which our people have regarded as constitutional for 200 years, is in fact unconstitutional. Justice Scalia's use of the word text was pointed, direct, and intellectually honest. That is the way he views the Constitution. He thinks at times that original intent could be unnecessary baggage. There's another mutation that has great appeal to me. I'm somewhat of a Borkian. In his first book, Judge Bork does something that I don't know that he intended to do, but it's something that I would be interested in discussing. He confuses original intent and original understanding. Now, if you think about it, original intent implicates a subjective test. I find that very difficult to deal with when interpreting the Constitution, because I think at times the elusive nature of original intent could create as much chaos, the kind of chaos that Federalist 78 condemned, as the so-called interpretivist model of constitutional construction, the model of Blackmun and Douglas and Brennan and Marshall and others throughout history who, Thurgood Marshall, who are very familiar to you. Bork, on the other hand, seems to implicate an objective test for what the Constitution means when there is a normative gap to be filled, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a normative gap that a judge has to consider. Bork argues that we're not being asked to decide what the framers of the Constitution would have said in a given dispute. Bork argues that what a federal judge must do is find the core value that the framers wished to protect. For example, it's easy to say that electronic surveillance comes within the reach of search and seizure, even though there was no electronic surveillance in the 18th century. It's easy to see how trucks can be regulated under the Commerce Clause, even though there were no trucks in the 18th century. If you go about, as Bork asks, defining the core value that was sought to be protected. Now, what do all these three mutations have in mind, have as a common denominator? Because they are all doctrines of gap filling. They are all doctrines of normative problems. But they share one common denominator, which I think makes General Meese more correct than Professor Byers. And the common denominator that they share is judicial restraint. It is that one element that binds us to the structure of the Constitution. It's no accident that Article I created the legislature and not the judiciary. It's no accident that Article II created the executive and not the judiciary. And it's no accident that we are the third branch of government, not the first branch of government. So if these documents have as their target a sensible way of gap filling, and if those doctrines counsel judicial restraint, then I think they are of more value in interpreting the Constitution than the models of some of our other friends, Justice Brennan and those of that school. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, the goal of the Federalist Society is to encourage debate over political policy, and I think we're achieving that here tonight. Judge Clement?
Well, I'm almost last. The good thing is that I'm almost last, and some people have said a lot of things I agree with, and, mostly Judge Feldman, quoting Judge Scalia. Justice Scalia is I think, a brilliant person. I agree with everything except for his new beard. I don't know if he knows it's bad. The bad thing about going last is that some people have focused on some areas that you want to discuss, and the debate forum, as established here, didn't allow anyone to really talk to one another about what we were going to do. We just wanted to see what the general was going to say and then comment on it. My main concern is the exercise of judicial restraint. And I think when General Meese discussed the fact that the Constitution's language at times is difficult to understand, what do? You look at the meaning at the time, whether it's the text or the intent. But what if you don't know? Then what do? If there is no answer, if there is no right that you can justify, I think you abstain. You just say no. You don't do it. You don't overrule the statutory regulation. Robert Bork said that where the Constitution does not apply, the judge must accept a posture of moral abstention. And you don't do anything until the representative comes up for election, and then you vote and try to express your concerns, your policy, make your policy statement at that time. You don't do it as a judge. Things that are morally right, things that are policy issues, should be decided by the people, by your representative. This is a republic. It's not the judiciary's role to make those kind of decisions. Also, judges have to remember and have to become, at one point, I guess some of us more than others were political, culturally involved. Once you take on the role of being a member of the judiciary, you become a political and a cultural neutrality. Judges who look outside the historic Constitution always reflect their personal beliefs, and that is not what you do when you interpret the Constitution. We don't have that kind of liberty. That's not the way our government was set up. The judiciary is not supposed to make major moral decisions. When that happens, when the judiciary legislates, it becomes chaotic. The state of the constitutional law interpretation by the courts, the legislation by the courts in the fields of religion and abortion and to some extent race have been explored by a friend of mine who's a professor of law at Northwestern, Stephen Presser, in an extremely good book called Recapturing the Constitution. I don't know if you're familiar with this. But he makes a very strong argument and a very considered position for what happens when judges legislate and how it goes wrong. The remedy for something like this is a constitutional amendment, perhaps, such as the remedy for the flag burning, where the court cannot say that the statute's unconstitutional. Well, the next step for the people is to make convince the legislators to go forward with the constitutional amendment. Also, I would like to recommend this for anyone who's really interested in the purist approach to the Constitution, recapturing the Constitution. There's a very recent case. Well, it's not that recent, it's this year, but it's a discussion by Edith Jones on the Fifth Circuit of the issue of school prayer. And I think she disagreed with the opinion. She disagreed with the request for a rehearing, which was denied. But she wrote a very strong dissent, and I commend it for your reading. It's 88 Fed 3rd, 274, talking about why the courts need to exercise judicial restraint, talking about why the courts should not legislate. She says that it's obvious that in disputes that are deeply enmeshed in social and political policy, they're not well handled by the courts, by the adjudication process. The court decrees, which focused on the single goal of pure non-establishment argument, in this case, the student body was allowed to say prayers of their own choice voluntarily if they wanted to do it. The Mississippi court said did not allow the school participation by the students. It had nothing to do with the government. This kind of an approach supplants decisions based on compromise and consensus, which reflect the multifaceted wisdom of the people, acting through democratically accountable elected officials and educators. Article 3 requires a real case or controversy implicating standing to sue, rightness, or justiciability. Now, that's what the district court can do. You can examine a case that comes before you on a constitutional ground. You can make sure that those people bringing the lawsuit, examining the statute, examining the will of the people, make sure those people have standing. Make sure it is a case or a controversy. Make sure that rightness has been attained. It's not a threat. There has to be real injury. There has to be real damage. You can't feel or fear that something's going to happen. It has to be a real controversy, not a potential one. And I think it's our job, at least I presume it's the role of the judge, to exercise judicial restraint to protect the Constitution and to make sure that we preserve the will of the people as expressed in the statutes and the Constitution.
Thank you, Joy. Well, we've heard from the judges and the law professors, of constitutional law professors. Dean, I know that you're not a constitutional professor, but we'd certainly like to have your commentary.
Well, that's certainly true. When I was asked to be on the panel, I questioned why I should be. As we've gone on down the line, I really am at the bottom here, not being an expert in this area. But I accepted to be a part of it, and in part because I think there is a role for a student who is not well-versed to ask the ignorant questions that perhaps some of you who are also not well-versed have. And so I'll try to fulfill that role. There are a few things that I did prior to coming here. I rushed to the library after looking up a few articles on Lexis and pulled out several articles, which I spent several hours reading. And there were a few questions that came to my mind that are brought up not only by those articles, but also by the talk today. For one, the Ninth Amendment. There has been some debate as to what the Ninth Amendment means, certainly in the originalist understanding. The Ninth Amendment reads, "The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people." As you know, the Bill of Rights gives rights to the people and restrict the courts in their decisions. Does that constitutional provision, in its originalist understanding, mean that rights that are not enumerated can be declared by the courts in the Constitution and be enforced as such? So I ask that as one of my questions. The second one is one that has been repeated here by two or three of our panelists, and that is, what do you do in a situation in which you don't have an interpretation, an originalist understanding of the Constitution? It may have existed, but perhaps the materials are not available. Perhaps there is something more than ambiguity. Perhaps there's a gap. What do you do to fill that gap? And there has been a statement there, by several originalists, that we really should leave that for the states. And we should leave for the states the decision of matters of morality. And so as another question I ask, what do we do about Brown versus Board of Education? In a talk that was published in 1987, General Meese indicated that Plessy versus Ferguson finally and fortunately was struck down in 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education. And yet there are some historians of the originalist ideas that say that Brown versus Board of Education could not have been conceived at the time of the 14th Amendment, the results in that. So what do you do in explaining a case such as Brown versus Board of Education? One final comment is, I am a firm believer in the concept of natural law, and there certainly was a concept of natural rights at the time the Constitution was formed. Who is supposed to decide whether natural law is the law in the nation? Is it the federal judge? Is it the state? There is a distinction between natural law and the law of the country. When you start taking natural law and you're putting it into the law of the country, you're making positive human law. And there is a distinction between the two. And it can be wrong, no matter how much you work at it. Who really is the person that should be, who is the body or bodies that should be engaged? And I do believe, as some have stated here, that in matters of deep moral concerns, you have to have a debate. And having that debate among the states rather than merely on a court of a few people does make a lot of sense. Now, that's a non-originalist reason for adopting originalism. But I think that we have to look at those reasons. One last reason, I think, is stability. What happens when you've got a Warren Court who imposed and brought to us several excellent reforms of our system in order to promote liberty, freedom, and justice, suddenly being overturned by a new court, which may not have the same beliefs? Where is our last resort? Shouldn't that have been something that occurred in the states rather than in the Warren Court? In other words, shouldn't those freedoms have been evolved through the states rather than through the Warren Court? Those are my few ignorant questions.
I think we've really had some excellent commentary by the panelists, and we thank you very much for that. We're getting near the end of the evening, and I'd like to call in General Meese for a wrap-up.
I'm glad we don't have to answer Dean's questions.
The answer is yes.
Well, I appreciate very much the excellent comments of all the people on the panel. I would just like to say that Professor Baer was kind enough to indicate his disagreement with much of what I've said, and I would like to return the favor that we have a common agreement of the importance of studying the Constitution and the doctrine. But let me just say that the place in which we part basically is not what should be done, because I agree with you that we need to preserve liberties, that rights are important, and so on. It's a question of who does it. And that was what I had hoped was implicit in my remarks, and that is that a part of our process of preserving liberty and democracy is to be very careful about who has what power and what ability to do what. And when you take away from the people's representatives, and that was echoed by a number of folks here, the power to represent the views of the people and make it a matter of rigid, if you will, constitutional doctrine by the court, you have then avoided the need for debate the dean talked about, the consensus that was talked about here, and the other things, and you've taken it out of their ability. I think it's important. Professor Baer said that for every right, there has to be a remedy. I agree with him for that right to be fully vindicated. But there's nothing in the Constitution that says that it is the court's function to find that remedy. The remedy should be found by the elected branches. Just as Chief Justice Marshall, as you were talking about, Chief Justice Marshall said that the Constitution needs to be adapted to each generation, but he was talking about the legislature doing that, not the court. I agree with Judge Fallon. I think the point that he made was very important about things not being liberal or conservative, and it is a matter of what did they mean. The reason the legislature, by the way, going back to Professor Baer and implicit in other comments here, particularly Judge Clement's comments and to some extent Judge Feldman's, a legislature has a different process and a different opportunity from what a court has. A court is necessarily constrained to the facts of a particular case. When the court makes a constitutional decision, it is made essentially for all time. A legislature, on the other hand, beside having the constitutional role, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many of us, is better able as a matter of process. First of all, it can take a long time to decide something. It has the whole issue in front of it, not just a portion of the issue as limited by the facts of a particular case. It can get all kinds of evidence and gather all kinds of evidence, whereas a court is often limited just to the witnesses in a particular case. It has the ability to forge the consensus that Judge Clement talked about and to bring people together so that the answer may not either be what the plaintiff asked for or what the defendant contended, but somewhere in between. And a court usually doesn't have that opportunity. So these are the reasons why the legislature is not only constitutionally a better place to solve the problems, but also is a better place just from a practical standpoint. I think that Judge Feldman's analysis and the doctrines of gap filling, as he called it, were extremely important and extremely valuable. I would say that I probably agree 99% with Judge Bork, and I would suggest that original understanding is the route to determining original intent. In other words, what was the meaning of terms at that particular point when people were making the decisions to ratify an amendment or to ratify the Constitution? And that's the route then to determine what they intended, rather than intent being some kind of a subjective judgment, which I likewise don't feel is appropriate. But the common factor in all of these methods of interpretation being judicial restraint, I think, is really the key to preserving the intent, if you will, of the founders in having a limited role for judges to interpret, not to make law. Judge Clement's agreement with the exercise of judicial restraint, obviously I agree with, but I think she raised an awfully important point. When the Constitution doesn't clearly prohibit the political branches from doing something, then the idea of moral abstention, which is a phrase I hadn't heard before, but which I, you can be sure will find its way into many of my speeches in the future.
It's a Bork phrase.
With or without footnote credit, it is a very important thing so that the court doesn't do, as she said, find itself supplanting discussion and the development of consensus. And finally, the dean raised some excellent questions, and they are the kinds of questions that we really need to discuss. And Justice Lemon, we could take another hour to do it, but I think these people are want to get back home in time to watch Jack Kemp and Al Gore in the debate. When, as you know, we're going to have a quarterback meeting a goalpost tonight. And that's not it. That's not original. In the interest of non-plagiarism and professorial fidelity, that was Mark Russell was the one who made that statement. He gets the footnote credit. But in terms of the Ninth Amendment, I've always felt that the Ninth Amendment was intended to raise the point that I have just raised with Professor Baer, and that is that the rights of the people don't just exist in the Constitution, but the rights of the people come from a variety of sources. They came in those days, they came from state legislatures, they came from Congress, and I think the purpose of the Ninth Amendment was to make sure, and it was really the answer to the people in 1787 in the convention who said, we shouldn't start giving a list of rights in the Constitution, because by implication we may then be saying that's the exclusive list of rights. And it was to make it clear that there were other ways that people get rights. But nowhere do I find anything to support the idea that there were a lot of ephemeral, unenumerated rights floating around that could be enforced by a court. There are a lot of rights that people have. There are a lot of rights that people should feel that they should have or that others should have. But unless there is a right that is reduced to some kind of a law, a statute that a judge can interpret,
then you are just leaving and calling upon a judge to bring up his own ideas of what the law ought to be rather than something in writing. A judge, by the nature of the judicial role, is there to interpret something that is specific enough to give him the basis to make a rational judgment. And that goes, that's the whole thing about natural law. In the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence, which I agree with you ought to always be read with the Constitution and vice versa, it says that they talk about the laws of nature and of nature's God, but then they say, and the rights that emanate from those laws, then they say, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, which certainly leads you to believe that it is the government then through the governing process, including the legislative process, that those natural rights are sufficiently defined by the people through the people's representatives and put into a form that judges can then apply them, construe them, and interpret them. And in terms of Brown against Board of Education, my view is that regardless what people were thinking about in the 1860s, that the original intent of the Constitution was that all men are created equal, and that a reasonable, going back to the core values, the Workian feeling, is that the Dred Scott, Plessy against Ferguson decision was wrongly decided, and that when you treat people separately in the context particularly of education, but also in other fields, they're not really being treated equal, and I think that was clear. And I would have been much happier if the Warren Court had simply overruled Plessy against Ferguson on that basis, that it had been wrongly decided based upon the original intent inherent in the Constitution, and that would have been better than the sociological gibberish which passed for legal reasoning in that particular decision. And finally, let me just say that I think that the dean has made a very important point in stating that for the sake of stability, it's important that the legislative process be the one that in the absence of a clear-cut constitutional reason, determine public policy. Because even though these are good ideas, even though these are important rights, even though these are valuable things in our society, the legislative process will prevent the kind of abrupt overturning, and then perhaps later on by some other court, the abrupt re-overturning of concepts in our legal system. And for those of you who are going to practice law, one of the most important parts about that, aside from the constitutionality, which is obviously supreme, and aside from the limited role of the judiciary, it's very nice and very important to have some stability in the law if you ever hope to tell your clients what the law is and apply it to their particular needs. I just want to thank this panel for being here today and amplifying so magnificently what they did, the remarks that I tried to start. Thank you.